Crosswires, navigating news with faith with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Crosswires, today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens, from a layman's questions and a clergyman's reaction. Now, here's Chris and Father Daniel.
Father Daniel, how you doing?
Chris, great to see you again.
Nice to see you. You ready for me to try to trick you?
Oh, gosh. All right, let's play a little bit of gotcha.
I read a recent story about a 100-plus-year-old Freemason lodge in England that's opening its doors to the public for the first time.
Oh, that's interesting.
So for those not familiar, Freemasonry was established in England back in 1717, and many famous Americans were Freemasons, like Ben Franklin and
FDR. Most of our founding fathers.
Yeah. The Catholic Church has historically had a negative view of Freemasonry. What are your thoughts on Freemasonry?
Yeah, not only a negative view, it's consistently said that excommunication for those who join Freemasonry, because they're in the rites and the beliefs of Freemasonry, it is actually anti-Christian, especially in the higher ranks of Freemasonry. They actually have to go through rites in which they step upon a crucifix and denigrate sacred objects and profess things that are contrary to Christianity. And that's why historically the church has always said it is incompatible for someone to be a Freemason and a Catholic, simply because it's a repudiation of Christian faith to participate, especially at the higher levels.
Stepping on a crucifix? Why are they required to step on a crucifix?
I don't know. You'd have to ask the Freemasons. But if you look in the higher rites, and again, there's differences between different groups of the Masons. You have the Scottish Rite Masons, and you have the French branch of the Freemasons. The French Freemasons, which spread off very quickly from England into France, were behind the French Revolution. And they were also very instrumental in the proliferation of Freemasonry in much of Latin America. So, for example, Mexico has an anti-Catholic constitution because in 1917, the Freemasons, who had the controlling power of the country, even though they were a tiny minority, they established a constitution which prohibited priests and nuns to wear their habit, kicked out any foreign missionaries, confiscated church property, even to this day. It's illegal to do certain things that are we would consider normal. That's why in much of Mexico, the Catholic schools don't have Catholic names. They don't have saint names, because if they did, legally, they could be confiscated by the government. I didn't know all these things growing up, but I joined the Legionaries of Christ, which is a religious order which was founded in Mexico, and so I learned all of these things over time. But the Freemasons have exercised tremendous power in world history since their founding. They do have many of these anti-Catholic, anti-Christian elements.
This story caught my interest because I was in New England for much of July. And when you go into a lot of small towns in like Vermont, New Hampshire, mm-hmm. you'll see the Freemason sign,
all over
their symbol. And it always kind of creeped me out, that square and compass with a G. I don't know why. Mm-hmm. It's kind of has a Stephen King feel to it, but I'm not sure why.
Yeah, the more you read about them and understand the history and some of the beliefs and practices, you can understand why the church has taken a strong stance against Catholics being involved in any way with Freemasonry. There's an interesting book that I read when I was first started off in the seminary called Behind the Lodge Door, published by Tan Books, and it documents a lot of the Freemason history of the United States of America, and the impact that individual Freemasons in very high-ranking areas, from presidents to Supreme Court justices, specific decisions that they made in light of their Freemasonry principles that have really negatively impacted the course of the United States. For example, the taking prayer out of public schools. That was a result of a Supreme Court decision with several Supreme Court justices who were Freemasons at the time. So it's really fascinating when you study that history. There's a number of interesting books out there about that. And the occult and even demonic practices at times have been linked back to Freemasonry. So it's no joke.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
The Wall Street Journal has a story about Newport, Rhode Island, and how they are ticketing people who violate a sound ordinance with a noise camera that automatically measures.
How do you see noise with a camera?
Well, it automatically measures sound, and it can home in on the car that's producing it.
Really? So, is it a microphone attached to the camera? Or
I'm not sure how it works.
Huh. Okay. Yeah.
But 83 decibels is the limit, and the violation results in a $250 ticket.
Wow.
In New York City, they have the same thing, and the first violation is $800, $1,700 for the second violation, and $2,500 for a third.
Wow.
Cameras that catch speeders and red light cameras, people who are running red lights.
Yep.
Those are common nationwide, but that has a, you know, safety element to it that I get. What are your thoughts about this systematically, you know, remotely measuring sound output and ticketing violators?
Well, I think anything that has to do with the common good is something that is responsibility of the government. So if there's something that is really, really loud that's causing, you know, a hearing loss for people or, you know, a deterioration of the environment, I think it's an impact safety, just like, you know, someone who's running a red light. So I think there's a legitimate grounds if there's, you know, vehicles that are really in excess or people that are honking really loud.
I could see where it's, if you're trying to deter drag racing,
yep,
that this would apply as a safety issue. I can't really see this being anything other than overreach otherwise. I mean, do you know what 83 decibels is?
No.
A lawnmower?
Really?
A noisy restaurant? A window unit, AC?
Mm-hmm.
So... I just think this is
excessive.
Think this is excessive.
Right.
I think this is, you know, if you were to look at it legally, the Fourth Amendment protection against unreasonable search and seizure. Mm-hmm. I think this just monitoring of everything that's going by and the noise, mm-hmm, and then snapping a ticket.
And just because we can monitor it.
Yeah, it just doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, that sounds like a little bit of overreach. And this is a great point, Chris, about how we need to dialogue about things as a society. Sometimes there might be one person who's on city council who just doesn't like noise and they want a more peaceful environment, and so they start imposing things unilaterally. Well, these are things we need to dialogue as a community, as a society, and say, okay, yes, there's a place for government to say if something's excessive noise, but what's excessive? You know, and let's come to a common agreement about what's good for our community.
Yeah, I just don't like the fact that this is being done remotely. Like, if you had a police officer who's witnessing a gang of motorcycles come down Main Street, you know, and it's upsetting the, you know, tourist industry,
right,
that's one thing. But just this remote measuring of sound, mm-hmm, this doesn't sound right to me.
Yeah, good point.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires. An organ harvesting organization has faced allegations during hearings recently before Congress that it urged doctors to remove body parts from a comatose woman from New Mexico who later went on to make a full recovery after medics insisted she showed signs of life. This was one example in the hearings. Another one was this organ donor waking up in Kentucky. As they are starting the surgery, he shakes his head and pulls his knees up during the procedure.
Oh my gosh. So, Chris, where do you find these stories? Oh my gosh. That is so macabre. I think you should have saved this one for Halloween or something.
Well, okay. The church considers organ donation morally acceptable.
Yes.
And even, you know, praiseworthy when done ethically.
Correct.
But the possibility of even these things happening would make me never sign up to be an organ donor. What's your thought?
Well, I think this is very, very important to take a hard look at and make sure that the people who are carrying this out are ethical people who are ensuring that the person is dead before they're harvesting these organs. There is a financial incentive, as we very well know, for these companies to harvest the organs quick, because if the person, you know, once the blood flow stops, the organs deteriorate very quickly. And so they got to harvest them quick and they get money from it. Okay. A lot of money. I mean, there's countries around the world that, thankfully, we have some regulation in the United States, but there's countries around the world where people are taken off the street and their organs are harvested.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, healthy young people. It's a travesty. And so there's some strong financial incentives for these companies to harvest quickly the organs. And whenever there's those type of incentives, there is ground for abuse.
I've been in some rural parts of Mexico before on like a guided trip, and I've said to my wife, I think I'm about to lose my liver.
Oh, you hope not, right?
Yeah, right.
Don't get in those places. Yeah. So, and I think here that the perspective of the church is, yes, it's a noble and good thing to, you know, offer to your organs when you die, but we need to make sure that there are safeguards in place to avoid bad actors from doing bad things.
Crossed Wires.
If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires. Great Britain will lower the voting age from 18 to 16 in the next national election as part of... Yes, as part of their measures to increase democratic participation.
Mm-hmm.
They join a short list of countries where the voting age is 16, which is alongside Austria, Brazil, and Ecuador.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts about this?
I think it's a terrible idea. Gosh, I mean, 16-year-olds that I know are so out of touch with the, what's going on in the world around them. They have little life experience. They're easily manipulated and led in different directions, which may not be good. They have, they lack the maturity to make good decisions.
You're not even close to being fully formed.
No. I think this is a really poor idea. I don't know who cooked up this scheme. I mean, I think you can make a case for, you know, I mean, this could be, you know, a little bit contentious, but I think you can make a case for there's an aptitude test before you can vote, that you have to have a modicum of understanding of what's going on in a culture and a society in order to make an educated vote for something.
Well, I think the voting age should start at 21, unless we're in a time of war and there's a draft. If you're drafting 18-year-olds, then they ought to be able to vote. But I think really 21 should be the starting age.
Yeah. But again, you know, we've talked about this a number of times, Chris. I think in a society, you need to have dialogue about things. You need to talk about issues and not just go with whatever is the fad of the time. One of the great strengths of our country with the founding fathers, there was so much back and forth on the prospect of starting a new country that they debated these issues. They really talked about them a lot. There was back and forth and they vetted ideas. And they came to the best possible configuration. That's why our country has lasted for the time it has in a fairly healthy way. And we begin to play around with those safeguards and controls at our own peril.
Well, what do you think about an upper limit on voting age?
I think it falls under the same criteria. I mean, what we have going on sometimes, unfortunately, is a manipulation of the elderly vote, where people will feed them false information. If they're in a nursing home, they may not have access to people. And they have people who will come in and tell them certain things or harvest their votes. It becomes a manipulation of the system. Now, you hear people talk about, oh, democracy, democracy. We're actually not in a democracy. We're in a republic, which we elect our elected officials who then make our laws for us. So democracy has its limitations, and one of those critical limitations is the education of the populace. If we are easily misled or manipulated by whatever forces it will be, then we're really, democracy can actually be very detrimental.
Well, last year there was that somewhat misleading video of Jimmy Carter, and it was claiming that it was him going to early voting, and he was 100 years old. Mm-hmm. I think he was just shy of 100, and he's got his mouth agape and is leaning back with family members around him. And he clearly is, you know, on his last legs. And, you know, 2 months later, he passed away at the age of 100. You know, it looked like he was barely clinging to life. You know, with regards to an upper limit, the Vatican doesn't let the cardinals vote after the age of 80.
That's right.
So I don't think 80, I think 80 is probably a much too low limit
for voting
for our political environment in America. Yeah. But, you know, 100 certainly doesn't seem unreasonable to me.
Yeah. Well, and that's why I think that there could be a valid dialogue about, is there a civics test that you have to pass, like a basic knowledge of what's going on in the world and what the candidates stand for, that you got to pass before you can actually vote. I don't think it'd be totally crazy.
To that point, you know who Mike Rowe is of the show Dirty Jobs?
No, never heard of him.
He says, well, you have a right to vote, but you also have a right to own a gun. Those that buy a gun have to
do a background check.
Yeah, and
you
and
some clear some hurdles.
And
first.
There are some responsibilities
that's
that come.
A great point. There's so many things like that in our society where, yeah, there's a basic right, but you also have to meet some basic qualifications. So maybe we should think a little bit more about that with the right to vote.
Well,
those kind of things we should discuss.
I totally agree with you though about Great Britain. I mean, 16-year-olds. When I was 16, I would have voted for Beavis and Butthead.
As a write-in candidate or because you thought he was on the ballot?
Definitely would have been Beavis for president, Butthead for vice. Following passage of Trump's federal funding bill in July, Planned Parenthood announced the closure of its Prevention Park location in Houston.
Thanks be to God.
Well, it was known as the largest abortion facility in the Western Hemisphere.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
The brick and mortar clinics in Texas and across the country are disappearing, but it's easier than ever to kill a gestating baby through just having a phone and a mailing address because of the pills you can get.
Yeah, the chemical abortions, unfortunately.
Abortion advocacy groups claim that abortion rates are actually up since the Dobbs decision, but they're basing that on the increased sales of abortion pills rather than the actual abortions.
Mm-hmm.
One study in Texas indicates that there was about a 3% increase in number of births in that state compared to the baseline expectations prior to Dobbs. Do you think that the closure of the Planned Parenthood clinic is that big a deal when people can just so easily go to an alternative?
I think it is, actually, because when the nature of the clinics, it gives legitimacy to the process. Women generally want to feel safe. And so that if they can go to a clinic, they'll feel safer about it. If they're in the isolation of their own home, they're not going to feel as safe. They're less likely to do it. They may order it, but they may actually have second thoughts. It's a very common practice, a very common occurrence that women, when they go to an abortion clinic, they would have second thoughts on the way and sometimes walk out if their boyfriend wasn't there or if the clinic personnel were not encouraging them and kind of shepherding them in an unhealthy way. So I think that the reliance on the abortion pills will be a less follow-through rate than you would if you had the clinics.
Yeah, I think
and less
that,
legitimacy in a certain sense.
Well, I think that this abortion by surgery involves the potential for more weight on your conscience than taking a pill.
Potentially. Although for women who have described going through the Mifepristone or whatever it's called, the abortion pill.
RU486.
The RU486. It is a traumatic process because the cramping, and then they sometimes deliver the baby and see it. That's pretty brutal.
Right, but that's after
and
the
scars
fact.
Them.
I'm thinking about before the fact that, you know, like you referred to the possibility of somebody...
Kind of pushing them in.
Well, or no, somebody having second thoughts because, you know, like you're going up to this clinic and you're, you know, the surgery versus the pill, it just seems like it's more chances for you to... I'm not saying that these clinics, I'm glad they're gone. I'm just saying that we need to consider the fact that the fight, you know,
is not
nearly over.
No, and I think this is the winning of the hearts and minds of people to realize the dignity of human life, the beauty of a child, even if it's conceived out of wedlock or in difficult situations, even in the case of rape. You know, and I have personal stories with this. I know girls. My older sister, you know, she got pregnant when she was 16 years old. And, you know, and a lot of people were telling her, you know, get an abortion. You know, your life is ruined. You're not going to be able to do anything. And my sister went on, and she's a medical doctor. And that daughter who was born to her is also a medical doctor.
Wow.
You know, and that life is precious. Every life is precious. And I think sometimes we talk about making exceptions in the case of rape. Does it make that any person less a person?
No, look, there's no doubt that abortion is wrong. Where what the focus on this particular news story, though, is that I think we've kind of this illegal abortion after a certain date in Texas. You know, abortion is almost virtually illegal at any state and at any point of the gestation in Texas.
Right.
But there's nobody really doing anything about shipping these pills across state line.
I think there are some attorney generals who have been working on something. I'd have to brush up and look at it. You know, Chris, you always throw these topics at me without any preparation, so I got to, you know, go on the fly. But if I recall correctly, there are a couple of attorney generals that are working to do something to curtail the RU486. And even I think the FDA is reconsidering the fast-tracked approval that it gave based on the number of problems, medical problems, and complications for women who are taking these pills. I mean, it was steamrolled through approval under the Biden administration. And there's some consideration like, hey, we need to revisit this and look at what is actually going on clinically and from a medical standpoint, all the side effects of this. And maybe this should not be approved. And I think that's obviously the my standpoint from the evidence that I've seen from a medical standpoint and from a moral standpoint as a Catholic.
Further to my point, though, about the potential flippancy with just taking a pill, I was in a Walgreens at 7 a.m.
Yep.
a couple weeks ago, and I was the only person in there. And then in walks this young female dressed very nicely, seemingly on her way to work. And she walks in the door and just shouts out to the cashier, "Where are the Plan B pills?" And he points to where she's supposed to go. And I was like, "That's just what just happened there?"
Yeah, that's unfortunate.
Yeah, it was so easy.
Yeah. No, I think you're right in that respect, Chris. It, the facility with which it can be done without thinking about it a little more flippantly, there's a real danger there.
Crossed Wires.
If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crossed Wires.
I read an interesting book review about a new book called Sex and the Citizen, How the Assault on Marriage is Destroying Democracy by Con Carroll.
Well, it sounds like an interesting topic.
He makes the case that our current cultural woes regarding marriage, gender, sexuality are the fruit of the same poisonous tree, which is the sexual revolution of the 60s. He argues that our current sexual revolution is actually the fourth revolution to take place in history.
Okay.
The first revolution he describes as taking place is when humans were hunter-gatherers, where males contributed nothing to the offspring, care of the offspring of their care of their offspring, and the females were just left to fend for themselves. The second revolution occurs when, with the rise of the agricultural society and the transition to humans settling in geographically fixed areas.
Okay.
So as rulers amass power, more entrenched social hierarchies form that separates the haves from the have-nots. Men who have power use their monopoly to sexually monopolize as many women as possible. And this second sexual revolution's destruction of the nuclear family leads to this unstable situation worldwide.
Okay.
Then you have the birth and spread of Christianity, the third revolution, where the moral teachings are precipitating the return of monogamy. And the novel idea then of men and women possessing inherent and equal dignity.
Okay.
He goes on to illustrate that the founding fathers found a link between Christian conceptions of monogamous marriage and that marriage and family were, according to the founding fathers, the essential building block of the Republic. This fourth revolution, he contends, has had the negative repercussions for our demographics and the health of our civic institutions.
He would say that this fourth revolution was like the 1960s.
Right.
Okay, got it.
So he's very critical of the U.S. Supreme Court, which over the past 60 years limited the state's role in encouraging a healthy marriage culture while simultaneously extending constitutional protections to contraception and pornography.
Mm-hmm.
I think he kind of nails it. What do you think?
Sounds pretty spot on to me. I mean, I think he might have missed some elements in history. If you go back, for example, to the Roman Empire, maybe it's a further elaboration on the second one that you were talking about. But the Roman Empire, I mean, there was some serious debauchery going on. I just finished a biography on Emperor Nero, and he had introduced gay marriage back in the...
Yeah, well, he's claiming, he's basically saying that was the end of the Second Revolution,
right,
and Christianity portends the
kind of a return to the monogamous family. And
right.
Yeah, got
right.
it. Yeah, I mean, it sounds pretty spot on, and I certainly see that in my pastoral practice, working with families, working with people, and I've seen it statistically as well. So I think that's pretty
close. Yeah, I mean, he sums it up in the end that, you know, we're heading the way of South Korea, where their population is on track to go from 50 to 25 million
right.
in just two decades.
Yeah. Well, I have a priest in my community, Father Abraham, who is from South Korea, and he has two siblings. Neither one of them are having children. they have no plans to have children. They're both married, and they're just not going to have children because they look at children as like a burden, can't afford it, they'd rather travel.
Yeah, you contrast that with, I made contact last week with a cousin who I hadn't seen in 40 years.
Yeah.
Another cousin was coming in town from upstate New York and organized this on impromptu family reunion, and it reminded me that my mom was one of 12, two of which never had children. Mm. One died young, another married, never had kids. But when my grandmother died in 91, I had 52 first cousins on my mom's side.
That's pretty good.
Contrast with what you're talking about in South Korea.
Well, they'll have no cousins, no children even.
Right.
Yeah, and you see what John Paul II called the culture of death, where you don't have any hope for life, and you just want to live in a comfortable way right now and here and now. You're not thinking about the future, not building for the future, not leaving a legacy.
Crossed Wires.
If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crossed Wires.
FAFO parenting, which stands for something we can't say on a family-friendly radio show. So we're going to say it stands
Chris, don't get yourself in trouble.
We're going to say it stands for fool around and find out.
Okay.
Wall Street Journal article writes about this mom named Carla Dillon who tried lots of ways to discipline her 13-year-old boy, including making him write the same sentence 100 times in a row like Bart Simpson had to do.
All right.
When he
Probably
sprayed
didn't
her.
Work.
Yeah. When he sprayed her with a water gun at a campground after she asked him not to, she saw only one option. Throw him in the pond, clothes and all. FAFO parenting.
Did it work?
Well, for her it did. So what are your thoughts on...
Well, parenting, in the very nature of parenting, is a certain amount of trial and error. There's no perfect formula. There's some principles that can guide, and you can look at the experience of other people. But as society shifts and changes, and, you know, parents 25 years ago didn't have to deal with kids having cell phones, didn't have to deal with certain factors that we got to deal with in society today. So there's always going to be a certain amount of trial and error, relying on the Holy Spirit, asking for grace, asking for advice, and crying out for help.
Well, I think most parents nowadays overthink it. I think no matter what, you're going to get some things right. You're going to get some things wrong.
True.
Even if you got things perfectly right, your kids are going to probably blame you in their adulthood for some issue that they have.
Yeah, there's no such thing as a perfect parent. And sometimes parents, they tie themselves up in knots. I think we need a little more humility, a little more grace, a little more reliance on the Lord. And just like, life is messy.
Well, and the other thing is, the more kids you have, the less you're going to micromanage the situation.
Right. And
I think sometimes they turn out a lot better. Well, and I think soft parenting culture of today is because we have had families with less kids.
Yeah, that's part of it, certainly.
If there's a topic you'd like Father Daniel to address, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crosswires.
Thanks for joining us. We'll be back again next week with a different take on the news.
This has been Crossed Wires, navigating news with faith, with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens on AM 1160, The Quest.